Ah, hello there. It's Paul Carenza here. That means this must be a Paul Carenza podcast. Thank you for tuning in once again. It's just catching up. That's what this currently is on this podcast channel, which is a slightly unusual thing I'm doing. I'm well aware it's not the thing people do on podcasts, but this is the place. You can hear lots of other previous podcasts I've done, interview shows like The Heptagon Club, Comedians with Books, and now we are catching up, which is really me finding some old friends and some new ones, really, and seeing how they're doing. So this time, that's the turn of Reverend John March. Now, I got to know John at university half a lifetime ago, and then some. And John is a lovely fella. We nicknamed him Random John because, well, he was slightly random in some of the things that he did and said, and I'm sure that will come across in this episode. John March has a podcast called The New Now, and in fact, I was delighted to be a guest on it. So I'm on his, he's on mine, and I'll put the link to that podcast in the show notes. It's called The New Now with John March and Matt Hogg. But right now, on this podcast, we talk about how, as a church leader, he can plan for what's coming back after a pandemic. In fact, we had this conversation in July of 2021, but I've held back until September 2021 to put it out there, because this does have a kind of a new term, a new year kind of feel to it. So some of his references to things like the World Cup and to the reopening of society, the easing of restrictions, that places it in July of this year. We also talk about how we both started at university, theology degrees, and we began by talking about the fact that John has several children, but I wasn't sure exactly how many. What does several mean anyway?
Now, settle a debate, right? This is a debate I'm having with my wife, which is several, in my mind, is four and above.
Yeah, I think
you have a couple, which is obviously two.
Then it's a few.
Then it's a few.
Yeah.
Three. I think two and three, that could be, you know, if you're not sure whether it's two or three, you say a few.
A few, yeah.
Possibly stretch that to four, but several does not qualify three.
I think you're probably right.
Because it really matters in terms of your recollection of events.
That's true. I can
see. When you get into marital disputes about, I asked you to do this several days ago, I want to know how many days are you referring to?
Yeah.
Because in my mind, several is four or five.
It seems like such a minor thing. And yet in COVID times, you know, oh, I was at this do. How many people were there? Several.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? You know, does that mean 40? Does it mean three? It's not two, is it?
It's not. It's definitely not two, because that's
several's
a couple.
Beyond two. Yeah, that's a couple.
And then you upgrade from a couple to a few, which I think is anywhere between two and four, because you don't know how many there are.
I have a few children. Not entirely sure.
Yes, you have a few children. You should know that.
Boris Johnson has several children.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows, just we don't. So
I'm presuming he knows.
I assume. I'm making an assumption there. I'm making several assumptions, a few assumptions.
A few assumptions in that case. So several, for me, in my mind's eye, does not equate to three.
Several.
I was waiting several hours.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's not three, is it? That's not three.
It's not three.
No.
I had several bars of chocolate.
that's a lot of chocolate, isn't it? Well, that's what's a lot. You know, I suppose a lot is relative, isn't it? I've had several pints. It doesn't mean three, does it? That means, I mean seven, but I'm not telling you seven.
Yeah. You want to say seven and you turn it into several.
Yes.
Yeah. Normally, if you've had seven pints, you could probably say several.
Yeah, who knows what you're saying by that point.
Yeah. I tell the younger members of my congregation that I remember the days, and you'll remember these too, of our Halls of Residence bar being a pound a pint.
No one, they wouldn't believe you now, would they?
They wouldn't believe you.
They wouldn't believe you.
Tell people these days, luxury.
I think we were at the tail end of a pound a pint, because I recall when I went to uni, I remember I had a few friends who were older than me, and they were talking about like pound a pint. And I was of an age like 15 or so going, what's a pint? You know, like a milk? No, okay. Or whatever. And then we got there, and generally prices were like, you know, 130, 150. But, you know, if you pick the right night,
it's
a pound a pint.
Generally Foster's.
Yeah.
Watered down. All other substandard Australian beers are available.
Yeah, absolutely. In those little plastic things that really broke as soon as you tried to.
As soon as you tried to carry any of them.
Yeah.
But, and if you carried three, you had to master the carrying the three to the table without spilling any.
What's
didn't
the,
you work behind the? Didn't you work behind the Rutland Bar?
I've never worked behind a bar. I was hall president of Rutland. So
no,
I should
that,
say,
I thought you, I thought I remember seeing you behind the bar pulling pints.
I don't think I've ever pulled a pint in my life. I've been behind the bar, probably, you know, I don't want to say being Lord of the Manor, but you know, the slight sense of I'm hall president. I can go and get a bag of crisps whenever I want and pay for it. But still, you know, it was a slight sense of that, you know.
Yeah, the smoking jacket embroidered with your name on it.
That's right. Yeah.
I remember, hall president. Yeah.
So I should say that, but you know, we've met at university at Nottingham and we did theology.
We did.
I was a year above you, I seem to recall.
You were.
And you are now 10 to 20 years above me in terms of your theological knowledge and understanding.
Very kind of you, because you went
and got vicared pretty soon after.
Yeah, no, I mean, at the time it didn't seem that soon. I certainly had no ambition of becoming a vicar when I went to.
I didn't think you'd do. You didn't mention it anyway when we were there.
No, it certainly wasn't a thing. My dad was a vicar, is a vicar. He's retired now, but my dad was a vicar, and I think people have different views when it comes to their parents and whether they want to do the thing their parents. I was one of those kids that, not because I had a bad experience being a vicar's kid at all, but I didn't want to do the same thing as my dad. I want to do something different. So you may ask, why on earth did you end up doing theology at Nottingham?
Oh, I should ask that question. So why did you end up doing theology at Nottingham?
Funny you should ask that, Paul.
Thanks.
I ended up doing theology at Nottingham because long and the short of it is that it was the only thing that I was vaguely interested in that would keep me going for 3 years and get a degree at the end of it.
That's exactly what I say when people ask me about it. Well, people don't ask me at all. I tell them anyway. gigs. When I do after show gig Q&As, because I've run out of material, and I explain about theology, I got to A-level and I thought, right, I've got maths, economics and religious studies. Which of these three could I see myself still being vaguely interested in 3 years from now?
Enough to get a degree of some kind that you can pass off in any environment.
Well, I heard that it's an arts degree. And I always thought, is it arts? Because it's theology and art. I suppose it sort of is. It's a bit of history, a bit of Latin probably. But I thought it's an arts degree. And they say that you can use that and get any job you like, or indeed no job at all. That's the thing. It's like a piece of paper it's like Doctor Who's ID that, you know, has nothing on it, but people, if they want to, they can go, oh right, that means something. And if they don't want to,
it's like
a
Jedi mind trick.
Why are you holding
this? It's the Jedi mind trick of degrees.
Exactly. Unless you turn it into something like you did.
True. And it was helpful. Is helpful still. But that was not what I was not intending to do theology. When I first applied for university, you'll remember the days of the UCAS form.
Oh, UCAS.
Now, your international listeners in...
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah, they won't necessarily know of the UCAS process. But when you're, as you know, when you're in your final year of permanent education, you have to apply for university if that's where you want to go. And you do so by in our days, to a UCAS form, which had to be immaculate. Do you remember black ink?
Absolutely.
Block capitals.
Fill in the boxes.
Fill in the box, and you had the UCAS handbook.
Yeah.
And you go, so thick. And then you look up the institution that you wanted to apply for the degree, and then it had a particular university code, and then the course that you wanted to do had the course code, and the two codes together formed the unique identification of the exact course that you wanted to apply for.
Good memory. I can tell that you're younger than me by at least a year, because I've forgotten all of this. Blocked it from my mind.
And you had to you could only apply for six institutions.
Six. I remember six. I only did four because I couldn't think of two more. So I just did the four. I'd only visited two of them. So I thought, I visited two. I haven't found time to visit the other two. So I'll just put down two randoms, really. You know,
it's a very odd process. So you go through and then you put your six things down. They have to be in alphabetical order. And then you had to write a personal statement.
Yeah.
And you had to, the personal statement was, here is 200 to 300 words on why you should pick me over above anybody else. Mm. And on there would also be your kind of predicted grades for your for your A-levels that would then get you into the course that you wanted.
And did you say in that bit of paper, I can't remember, did you have to say, I really like Nottingham / Sheffield / Kent / Manchester, brackets delete as appropriate, depending on where you are?
It was, I remember there were some people in my, when I was at school who were doing this, who were super cocky. They were the kind of people that would be like, I'm just going to be a real, like, couldn't care less about this. But they played the high risk game in their personal statement. You know, they'd say, you know, they'd say, obviously they'd say this kind of completely tongue in cheek, but they'd say things like in their personal statement, things like, well, I can't think of what else to do with the next 3 years of my life, so I may as well apply for the, you know, and they would just throw that in there. And I'm thinking, that's a high risk strategy.
Tough. Yeah,
I played it safe. So I applied, but when I went through the whole system, my initial plan was to do business studies. So actually I applied to European business studies at Loughborough, or as Americans like to say, Lugerbrugger.
I thought you say, as Americans like to say, Bisonless Studies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right. Lugerbrugger, that's the one.
Lugerbrugger.
Loughborough.
So I applied to the European business at Loughborough, and then I took my gap year as a youth worker in Cardiff. So I did youth work for a year in Cardiff. And during that year, decided that I didn't want to do European business at all. So went through the process of reapplying, where you had to get out yet another UCAS form and do the whole thing all over again.
You'd love that form so much.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
But it was, it also cost me, because I was the first year that tuition fees were introduced.
I was just thinking, we were the tail end of that, but I was, and you clearly weren't.
Well, I would have done if I, you know, because I had my application, me and you in the same year group, because I don't think you had a gap year, did you?
No, I didn't. I went straight there. Yeah.
So we were in the same school year group. And because I deferred entry, the tuition fees didn't apply to me. But because then I had started a brand new process, suddenly I was on the hook for, in those days, the big money of £1,000 a year.
Yeah. Yeah. It came in then, didn't it?
Yeah.
And in fact, you know what? I'm now off at 42 and I won't do this, but, you know, I had a thought about, I'd like to do another degree. I'd like to do a history degree. I'd like to do the degree I always wanted to do until I, you know, that I should have done to begin with. But then I thought, no, it's not like the old days. You can't just turn up and do it for free and fill in a UCAS form with block capitals and all that. It's changed. It's changed.
It is.
So I don't quite know if I will muster the energy and indeed money to do a 3-year degree.
Right, exactly.
Like I'd like to.
Well, so I applied for this thing and I only had one because I was living in Cardiff and I grew up in the other side of the country in Canterbury. And so my parents lovingly sent this physical UCAS form that I had to get absolutely perfectly right to send off and write. So I had my UCAS handbook and I had my, you know, black ink pen. I filled it out and the course I was going to apply for was to do teaching with a religious studies emphasis. You always had to have one emphasis. And because I enjoyed my youth work that I was doing in Cardiff in a church, I thought, oh, I'll do that. So I filled out my UCAS form. And as I filled it out, I realized that I'd filled out this form wrong.
Oh.
And I'd filled in Nottingham Trent, not Nottingham University.
Rookie error.
And so I realized in that moment that I had to choose a degree from Nottingham University to make. Sorry, I filled in Nottingham University, not Nottingham.
Oh,
Trent,
I see. Way. Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
Sorry, that way,
but either way, they are near each other, but they are not
near
each
other. And certainly alphabetically side by side in said UCAS handbook. So I filled in this form and I put Nottingham University. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't want to apply for Nottingham. I was trying to get a teaching degree from them. They didn't do a teaching degree at Nottingham University.
Wow.
So I was like, well, I have to have something that matches this personal statement that I've written for all the other ones. So I thought, well, I'll look down the list. Oh, there's something vaguely religious. I'll do theology. So I filled that in, went to the, to my surprise, even though my actual grades, not my predicted grades, were one short of what they wanted, they offered me an interview. So I show up at the interview, having not intended to put it down in the first place. And the guy interviews me, he said, so your grades are pretty good. And I thought, my grades have never been described as pretty good in the past. This is not something that people have ever said about my academic prowess. And he said, yeah, you did pretty well. A for German, B for business studies, C for history. I was like, didn't get an A in German. They were like, says on your form you did. I was like, I definitely didn't. Because your school fills out your grades, what you get. You don't fill them in.
Right.
And my school had written down the wrong grade.
No way.
On my UCAS form.
Hang on, let's stop. So you, you did a three-year degree because of a spelling mistake and indeed probably found a vacation because of it. God works mysterious ways. You wrote the wrong name of the wrong university down. Yeah. And then
got an interview on the basis.
The school spelt your grades wrong. When you spelt one letter wrong, you know, you meant to write a C and you wrote an A or whatever. I don't know. Like, who knows? But do you know? So
then he said to me, oh, well, you're here now. Do you want a place?
Simple times.
I ended up at Nottingham University through no intention at all.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Yeah. So really, I've been living a lie all this time.
Well, that fits your, I mean, your, I don't know how, if this lasted beyond university or before it, but Random John was your nickname at university.
It was.
And this suits that perfectly, doesn't it? I mean, this is a random, you know, when people go, well, what do you mean random? Because that was a thing people said back then. It's so random. In fact, I think that came in after. I think the, you know, kind of American high school, so random thing came in later. I recall being a little bit narked that they borrowed, taken it, because you were random, you know. I mean, that is a random thing. But you're a bowling ball bouncing off the sides of these buffers that somehow then pings over and causes a strike in the next lane, you know.
Right, that kind of thing.
Good on you.
And much to the frustration of a lot of my friends who are like, how did you blag that?
Yeah.
You didn't even try and blag that.
It's a trick shot at snooker, but you are basically a living trick shot at snooker.
There we go. Oh, that's something for my LinkedIn profile.
You can have that. You bounced off one table, down the road, jumped up the stairs, bounced into the local snooker hall. And
not the pen.
Yeah, exactly.
The person writing the UCAS form.
Absolutely. Boom. Well, so there you go.
Every so often I see people from university and they'll say, Random John. I'll be like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
But it got to the point at university where I no longer, the John bit of the name got dropped. So people just shout random at me.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just a normal, and I'll be like, hi.
Yeah, that's your name. Yeah.
Yep, I mean, that's me. Yeah.
And then, as I recall, you then moved to, after uni, when you went to sort of North London, which is, you know, still where you have your flock. And then Random John became Camden John. It was almost like you deliberately found a place that sounds a bit like random.
Yeah.
You go, there you are.
When you do the rhyming dictionary of places that sound like random, there aren't many.
No. It was that, or going to fandom. Or Phantom John.
That'd be a different career.
So theology finished then, and then you did your, what, you do a conversion course or something, or you theological college?
So I did a couple of years interning, because what else do you do after you know, we talked about like getting this degree and you're like, well, now what?
Yeah.
Why did you do theology? Well, to get me a degree. So now you've got the degree, so now what? Mm. So I did a couple of internships because I didn't know what. And one of them was out in the States working for a church in Chicago. And then I came back from that and I did my theological training as a vicar. And I did that in Oxford for a couple of years, where a friend of ours, we passed like ships, Henry and I.
Mm. Our mutual friend, Henry, Reverend Henry Curran, who left, as I said on a previous podcast, on your podcast, in fact, we should mention to anyone listening, if they think, hey, I'd like some more of this scintillating conversation, but elsewhere and with another person involved, I had a conversation for your podcast in which you can hear us talk about Henry Curran, who was a friend at uni, who left uni and walked out of it, turned left, found a church and went, that'll do, I'll have that one. And he's been vicar of that church from then till now for a couple of decades. First church he found, I'll have it.
So I bumped into him. Second kind of experience of bumping into Henry pre-joining an institution. So I did the same thing with you. I met you and Henry on the first day of university at Nottingham. Mm-hmm. And you welcomed me with open arms to the halls of residence. And then had a similar experience of when I was checking out theological colleges, Henry was at one of the ones I was checking out.
Mm.
And that's where I ended up in Oxford. So I did 2 years training there and then moved to London. And which is where I've been ever since, or lived around a bit around London, but did what they call your curacy, which is your kind of practical apprenticeship, apprenticing is the word I was looking for about 3 years, and then you go off and be a vicar somewhere, which is what I've been doing really ever since up here in North London.
And you've been there for some time now, haven't you? And it's, it feels like only yesterday. But how's that experience been? Has it been everything you imagined that vicardom would be, and more? And indeed, and London as well, being sort of part of a North London, that must be different. You know, Henry's got this Nottinghamshire.
Yeah.
You know, well, actually, he's on the edge of a town, I suppose, isn't he? But it's, you know, you're right. You're in London. You're in the thick of it, aren't you? You're right. Yeah. There, well,
it's hard work. And most of the things that they teach you in college, you don't need. And most of the things you do need, you don't get taught. And I don't blame anybody for that. It's just the reality of the job is that one moment you're, you know, you've got to be a public speaker. Another moment you've got to be a civic figure, you know, some kind of community leader. Another moment you are chairing a board of, essentially a board of trustees, what we call a church council. Another minute you've got to get your head around a budget, a finances. If you have staff, you've got to be good at line management and all that kind of stuff. And you've got to be good at pastoral care. You've got to be good at what you say to somebody when they're dying. You've got to, you know, how do you prepare people for their marriage? You know, every part of life is covered. So I think a lot of the things you're trained for is a lot of the kind of, rightly so, the outward facing stuff of ministry, which is the, which is the kind of the stuff that people see. I think the stuff that you're not really trained for, and I think is really challenging, is all the other stuff that goes on behind the scenes to make everything else happen. How do you chair a good meeting? You kind of work out as you're going along. How do you make sure that administratively the church is running well? How do you make sure the finances are working? All that kind of stuff is the stuff that you don't really do much of, but really makes everything tick. And a lot of my work is around that stuff, the background stuff. You know, as people often say to me, I often thought that, I mean, before my dad was a vicar, I often thought that, what else does a vicar do from Monday to Saturday? Yeah. So, because the visible stuff is only that one day a week.
Of course. Yeah. And I always think it must be a split level thing that you've got, if you're running a church, that it's for the people who come to it, but it's also the people who don't. So you are running a business to a degree, or an organization or community that's there for those people who will see you at their most important times of their lives, at, you know, births, marriages and deaths and things like that. And indeed, I suppose putting things on that you hope they might come along other times. You know.
I think it's William Temple that said that the church is the only organization that exists for its non-members, former Archbishop of Canterbury, I think. And it's true, but that can often be in tension because, you know, the energy that you place, you know, wanting to be a place of welcome for those that are not yet part of your community in that sense, can feel at odds sometimes with the people that are there. The people that are there feel, oh, well, I don't feel cared for if you're doing, if you're off there doing that. And you have the same 24/7 hours that everybody else has. And so I think that is challenging, but I think that kind of, I mean, I've learned a lot. The church that we were in, we was closed for 20 years before I was asked to take it on. So it was a derelict church. It was structurally sound, but as a building, it was derelict inside. It was dry rot in the floor, wet rot in the, dry rot in the ceiling, wet rot in the floor. The electrics weren't earthed. So for however many years, people would be turning on the light switch and thinking, there's a possibility I might die by turning these light switches on.
At least you're in the right place.
Exactly. Yeah. The distance between death and the funeral will be quite short.
That's true.
I'll just shift him a bit to the left now. It's fine.
It's a short commute. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So we took on this empty building, and it was due to be closed six days away from being sold. So, and we took it on, and it's still standing. I like to say that, you know, from the moment I joined, we had church growth. And
that's true. Yeah, yeah.
The only way is up. You can't really sink it into the ground any further than it was.
Yes, your graph must look quite impressive. That's a big old spike you got.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Look at that. Year one, 100% growth.
Whew.
So, yeah, so it, that I really enjoyed. But I think often the challenge is in maintaining it beyond the kind of kickstart.
And how's it? I can only imagine that in the last year, with, you know, a mix of some parts of church moving online, but other parts, of course, people still need to be there in person. And
yeah.
then coming through that and to whatever's next. How's that been for you? Has it been utterly bananas, or have you not had a chance to reflect on it yet?
Yeah, it's been mad, really. It's been really challenging. And I think for those of us that are used to kind of planning at least 6 months, if not a year or two ahead, saying, you know, this is where we want to be, that kind of went out the window immediately. And initially you're working week to week, you know, what do we need to get done this week? I kind of framed it at the beginning that with the team, I said, listen, the first thing we need to be doing is thinking defensive. So, I mean, I can't go at the moment without making reference to the football. By the way, it's coming home.
It is.
Or maybe when people are listening to it, it has come home.
It's true. By the time we should do two versions of this, like, oh, it was great when it came home, wasn't it? And oh, what a shame that it nearly came home and stopped at the doorstep.
Yeah. Came home and decided, nah.
It was on the way home, but we were out, so it was delivered to a neighbour.
Exactly.
A neighbour across Europe.
You know, every good football team is built on defence. You've got to have a good defence. So I just kind of said to the team, listen, let's just work out what we need to get done. You know, let's not try and be particularly ambitious. Let's just cover the bases. And then from there, we'll be able to have a stronger position from which we can do more kind of outreachy things. But it's been really challenging. It's, you know, the constantly moving goalposts, trying to use it as an opportunity to be creative in what we're doing, but at the same time, everyone's exhausted. You know, so there was an initial real excitement about online church. So lots of people tuned in online initially, and then that kind of ebbed away. Because the reality is people want to see one another and be with one another. And so we actually, until the beginning of June this year, we'd not met regularly face to face. There were certain things that we did every so often face to face, like Easter and Christmas, we had face to face, socially distanced and so on. But a lot of the restrictions of what, you know, even as lockdown was easing for most of the country, things like pubs and things like that, for the church, it was still no singing. It still is no singing.
It still is, isn't it? Yep. At the time of recording, in any case.
Exactly.
Probably at the time of this being out there in the world, singing, because it will be after be July 19th,
so
2020.
I'm really enjoying singing.
Yay.
Right now.
Exactly. Singing is coming home, or not.
It's exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the pubs, you know, the pubs were filling up, the restaurants, you'd be able to eat inside. All that stuff was happening. Meanwhile, at the time, the churches were still, you know, not allowed to sing, socially distant, masks on. If you had to take communion, you could only take communion with the bread, not the wine, and children's work was really hard. They were just still trying to maintain bubbles for children, and your bubble at school is different from your bubble at church, and so how do you maintain that and do that well? So we've just found it, you know, the logistics. And I would say that there's not many church leaders, clergy that you speak to who aren't absolutely shattered, and a lot of that is just decision exhaustion, you know, decision fatigue. They're just kind of, okay, what does next week mean? You know, when you've made certain in the life of anything, whatever you do in life, whether as a parent or as in any form of work, it's your routine that you kind of, that's just always there in the background. And everything else, and then that routine enables you to build everything else into it. Well, once the routine went out the window last March, like, I mean, as a parent, we were suddenly homeschooling four kids. My wife's a teacher. She at the time, as a primary school teacher, you have curriculum leads. So, you know, you have your classroom, but then you happen to be looking after reception, but you have a curriculum lead in. You also are looking after for the whole school, maths, for example. Mm. Well, my wife's curriculum lead was computing, which pre-COVID was like, oh yeah, do a few courses, no problem. Suddenly, and she had actually moved, she'd actually had a meeting about 4 weeks before, I think 4 weeks before COVID hit and lockdown hit, where she had a chat with the Google guys and said, you know, how do we bring our IT provision up to speed and a bit more online and blah, blah, blah. And she had basically an 18-month plan laid out, which basically within the 2 weeks of lockdown, you know, 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later, was all up and running.
You know,
an 18-month plan got contracted to 6 weeks. So all of that routine just fell out of the bottom, and we were all trying to have to work out what our new routine was. And it's the same for church, is that the everyday stuff of we have church services at this time, and this happens on this day, and we have, you know, prayer meeting on this day, and we have alpha on this day, whatever it is, suddenly kind of went out the window. And so we're like, okay, now what do we do? And every time the restrictions have either eased or not, we've had to make those decisions again. Mm-hmm. And part of me, whenever this is coming out, but I'm looking now in July, looking ahead to September, thinking, is there going to be another wave? Is there going to be local lockdowns? The numbers are surging again. So we basically pivoted, to coin a phrase that was used a lot in lockdown, and basically tried to create something that would withstand all of the ebbs and flows of being able to meet with various restrictions. So we created different structures around that, which we're now moving out of. It's been really challenging.
And it's difficult to know how to, you know, this time next year, where we'll be, really. And in terms of, you know, I see as a comedian, I'm booking gigs now for, in fact, someone offered me a gig this week. Someone this week had offered me a gig for 2 years' time for 2023. And they even said, are you free on this date in May 2023? And I go, yeah, I don't know. Presumably there is still a comedy circuit. probably. But it's difficult to even plan. And gigs for September that, or even August that are cancelling now because there's not the confidence that the venues have of knowing, can we fill this? Because generally in comedy land, you need about 80% capacity to break even. So you, you know, you can do less than that, but then it becomes sort of not so worthwhile in that sense. But with restrictions changing, but even then restrictions change, and then there seems to be a bit of a lag time before you can kind of see the effects of those changes, but also what the public mood is, I guess. You know, who is, if you went, I don't know, are you online at all now for your church things? Or are you entirely in person?
Like a lot of churches, we're doing hybrid, and actually we're going to keep doing hybrid for a while because I think there will be people that, no matter what the restrictions say, have an unease about joining in large groups of people.
Yeah. I miss communion. I've not taken communion now for well over a year, and I always used to like it. I used to feel it was a very special thing. And we've been to church a couple of times, but they haven't had communion there, those ones, and I'm missing it. And I don't quite know in what way I will have it again. I will have it again at some point. But I think back to churches I've been to in the past where communion wine comes around in little mini tubes or something like that, or pre-shredded bread or whatever, or bring your own, I don't know, and then you're going to be blessed. But things like that, there are certain aspects of church life and life at large that it's tricky to know exactly where we'll be in a year. But
which is what contributes to the exhaustion. Because you're, even when you start making plans, part of you is thinking, am I going to have to make two plans? One is, I'll book that date for 2023. But in the back of my mind, I ought to have another plan. You know, I know that's an extreme example, but even if you think about September, you're thinking, I'll take those dates, but maybe I need to have another, you know, plan in place.
Well, this, and the government phrasing we often hear about, we're going to have to learn to live with it. I get that. And I think I agree with that, but in a way it's only helpful as a headline, because I kind of want to know, but we need to know what the detail of that looks like in all sorts of parts of society. So we need to learn to live with it, but does that mean we are no longer going up and sharing communion goblets or packing ourselves onto airplanes package holidays? Or, you know, this is a minor thing, but it's just reflective of it all. But, you know, 12th night we have in our local pubs in Guildford, we tour around 6th of January, a mummer's play, a traditional medieval mummer's play. And it's, you know, some carols and, you know, kind of jester's hat. And it's this ancient medieval thing. And part of that is the wassail bowl, this giant punch bowl. It's passed around the entire pub. Everyone takes a sip. And, you know, I think they say that culturally it shares some sort of heritage with communion, you know, with the fact that we are a community. We share this together.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and, you know, I've even read in books, people say, well, this, the idea was like, if it's poisoned, we're all going down together. It's that kind of feel like we're all in it together.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't quite know when the wassail bowl will be passed around a well over capacity pub. You know, I'm talking like 200 people crammed into a room that can really comfortably fit 12. I don't quite know when that's going to happen again.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a joyous thing that I might look back on and go, oh right, that was until I turned 40 or 41, and then that stopped for decades. I don't know. Is that a thing that comes back on? I don't know, but we'll have to see.
And I think what makes that hard is that those of us who are in places where we are called to gather people together, we are asked at a local level to make our own minds up.
Right.
And so we become the kind of decision makers and, you know, so you know, as we're speaking now, the restrictions are going to be lifted, you know, handbrake off July 19th. And so
good luck, everybody.
See you on the other side.
Yeah.
And on 25th, we've got just a big service happening. And we want, there's a natural desire and excitement. Let's gather back together. Let's sing for the first time together in 18 months, whatever it is, 16 months. And yet we also are very aware that there'll be people that it feels uncomfortable. Even I'm an extrovert and I love being with people and gathering people together and so on. And I love singing. And so this is kind of tick, tick, tick. But even I walk into and anticipate that and think this is going to be quite overwhelming being suddenly in a group of 200 people, not socially distanced. So we're creating space deliberately. And I think that is our mandate as a church. You know, there's a bit in the Bible that talks about character, to carry one another's burdens. And in our individualistic society, you've got people saying, I want the right to do this and I want the right to do that. And I think as a church, we get to model something different that says, we can hold this together. So we're going to have a space which is going to be for those that want to be socially distanced in the church building that day.
Oh, great.
And we're going to ask that everybody, even though we can take the masks off, we're going to ask that everybody keeps them on while we're singing. And maybe when the talk is happening or whatever, we drop them down if you want. And we still do track and trace on the way in, and those are the things that we're kind of currently experimenting with, as we've only had to think about it since Tuesday or whatever it is. But we want to create a space where everybody, and we'll do online streaming for those that are shielding or whatever, because the numbers are still rising.
Well, I'll tell you a bit I won't miss, and this is even again looking ahead a month or a year, who knows how long, but like I said, I love communion, big fan of communion.
Yeah.
It means something to me, but and I like sharing the peace as a theory. The idea of sharing the peace, big fan of that as well. But in practical terms, every other week at our church, there's always someone who you can see making a beeline for you. And as he's on his way over to you, he's like sniffing, wiping the hand on the nose, and gets the old hanky out of pocket, and you can see it's not been washed in 5 years, and it's wet, unused, and it's back in the pocket. Hand out, coming towards you. Oh. Peace be with you. And yes, peace. And also that cold I'm going to get in 4 days from now. Yeah, and every time it happens, and I get it, and I can go, I can tell you where we got this cold from. It's Dirty Jeff down at the, with his snotty hanky. So, I mean, little things like that, you know, I'm well aware that, you know, the handshakes, the elbow bumps, all of that, you know, I've been doing respectful bows. I've been quite enjoying the respectful bow. But when we share the peace, you know, is it going to be gloves on? Is it going to be, you know, those ones you get at a petrol station by the petrol pump? Maybe every church has one of those next to the communion goblets. Help yourself. Yeah. Quick handshake, then it's in the bin. You know, yeah. I don't know. It's a barrier, isn't it, to community? And we have to find ways over those.
I think one of the things it has done, which has been really helpful, is that it has made us much more aware of how others who live in a state of vulnerability live their lives. Pre-COVID, post-COVID, this is just reality. Those who are immunosuppressed, those who struggle to come to church through kind of disability or whatever, you know, actually what it's made us aware of is others, others for whom this is a reality, not just for a season, but for their lives. And I remember somebody saying to me quite early on, they said, you know, we are on lockdown, we're in isolation, we're stuck at home, we can't see people, we look at screens if we're going to do anything at all. And she just simply said, and I thought it's one of those most profound moments, I think, of that entire first lockdown, really. And she said, we have joined their world. And this is what it's like for people who have to stay at home for whatever reason. And this is just reality for them. And I think if we as a church, if we can get our heads around, actually, there is something really powerful about being aware of those that are having to self-isolate in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, then our churches will be better off for it. If we're looking at our physical spaces and we're aware of one another, actually people that don't want to shake hands or hug or whatever. Like I saw this really cool thing on Twitter a couple of days ago, and it wasn't for a church, it was something else, but I thought, I might borrow that, where they had different color lanyards. I don't know if you saw this. It's a bucket of red lanyards, a bucket of orange, and a bucket of green, and a sign above each one that said, take this if, and you know, green is I'm up for hugs and high fives, yellow is I'm happy to spend time talking but please don't hug or high five me, and red was I'm going to be distant, I'm not going to blah blah blah. And it's a way of people on the way into what I think it was a conference or whatever it was, being able to identify what they were happy with and what they weren't happy with, again making us more aware that just because there is a kind of cultural norm, that doesn't mean that everyone feels included in that. And I think that if nothing else, if we as a church can learn to be mindful of others that are not, you know, just like us, then I think that's a win.
That sounds like the respectable version of those traffic light parties that I'm sure we also had at university with the pound of pint beers. But I never went to one, but I think I always thought of wearing a sash that just says out of order. But we should wrap up because we've talked plentifully and well. But
I feel like there's a lot to catch up on.
But there is. Maybe we need a part two. Maybe we need a whole podcast. It's just, you know, setting the world to rights.
And reminiscing, indeed. Reminiscing about, you know, rag raids and...
Rag raids. Oh, yeah, I remember those.
Oh, I remember, Paul, when you introduced the big screen TV into the common room.
I'd forgotten that. I'd remember. Yes, that's right. We I had a bit of money in the kitchen.
Yeah, a tiny little thing in the corner. And you got some of this common room money. But that was the thing, right? If you wanted to watch TV, you had to go to the common room and work out between 200 of you what TV channel you were watching.
Yeah, that was tough. And I remember the introverts who'd get there early and think, I just want to watch that thing, that quiz show, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly it was like, you know, suddenly the lads come in, forget that, watching a football, you know, and it just turns out, you go, oh, well, I've had my fun. I've had 20 minutes of Weakest Link, whatever it was, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. You mentioned pound a pint earlier. I wanted to finally say, what's the most expensive pint that you've ever bought?
Oh.
And while you're thinking of it, let me see if you can top this. Monte Carlo, I did a gig in Monaco, and it was £10 a pint. And so there's me asking you a question, just an excuse to tell you this, really.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Me and three other comedians, so four of us in total, and everyone in the audience was like a billionaire. They had their yachts parked outside of the marina, you could see. And they gave it, and they had, it was free drinks tokens during the show, but they said it's only during the show. And we were, of course, all like, oh, yeah, well, we're working. We won't have a drink during the show. We clearly should have done, because afterwards, like, I'll get these, you know, it's all right. The drinks tokens may have expired. I'll go and just get a round of drinks for everyone, thinking like £3 each, £3.50. London prices, maybe £4. Came back shaking with the beer tray with £40 worth of four beers. Oh. And we made those last.
Yeah, you would. What do they call it? Nurse that one, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Nurse those pints. Yeah. No, I can't quite beat £10. Although I've done a wedding in Monaco.
Have you?
Yeah.
What were you presiding?
I was. They had the civil ceremony bit. in Monaco, in the town hall. It's very formal, very contractual, you know. So we're there gathered, and the couple are in front of the desk and in the town hall in Old Town Monaco. And it's very contractual. It says, you know, do you agree to take 50% of the cost and the expenditure of the, you know, do you agree to commit to 50% of raising the children? You know, very kind of absolutely contractual. And I was doing the spiritual bit on the beach at the end of the day.
Nice.
So, but I've got a story to go with that one day, but that's for another podcast. Ask me about the Monaco podcast, Monaco wedding I did.
We'll plant that as a little teaser for next time.
Absolutely right.
Well, Reverend Random, I'm delighted that you made that spelling mistake on that UCAS form many years ago and found your way to the priesthood. We call it the priesthood. I suppose it's the priesthood.
We'll call it that today.
Let's do that. Thank you for joining us, and Godspeed. You know, whatever that may mean, whatever speed you want to go at, may it be Godspeed.
Slowly at the moment, I think.
That's John March, Reverend John March, Reverend Random John March. Thank you for joining us. What a fella. That was an illuminating chat, I'm sure you'll agree. His podcast is called The New Now. You can hear me on that podcast talking about how to be creative and lead things in different ways in this new abnormal, I suppose. I'll put the link to that in the show notes. Next time, we are joined by comedy writer James Carey, talking about comedy, religion, and all sorts of other things here on Catching Up, a Paul Carenza podcast. I've been Paul Carenza. This continues to be a podcast for another approximately 3 seconds. Goodbye.